Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo. Today we're going to be expanding mind power into application power. And in what medium? Well, it pretty much could apply to just about any level of life. But my guest today, Dana Ardi, is going to be especially addressing the business world, business environment. We have gone through such phenomenal changes in the area of industry and business, and good, bad, or indifferent, it's always going to be around. But what are some of the greatest shifts? What could you, as an entrepreneur, if you are listening to this show, what do you think you might benefit from in listening to what Dana has to say? Well, I think what Dana's book, The Fall of the Alphas, The New Beta Way to Connect, Collaborate, Influence, and Lead, is a different turn on a subject that leaders throughout the century that really knew their stuff proposed. And I think you're going to find that it is very relevant in today's fast-changing world. Dana, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you very much, Donna. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, I was surprised to learn about a brand new label, Corporate Anthropology Advisors. When I saw that, I said, whoa, when did this come about? I have not ever heard that terminology applied. So you being one of those people who actually you're going in to environments and helping them in business environments, helping them to transform, if it is needed, which frequently it is, their businesses so that they can enjoy success. You have been a partner managing director at CCMP Capital and JP Morgan Partners, and you were a partner at Flatiron Partners. You also were an operating executive. You've got background managing behind you, and you've been involved with a number of leading firms in this country. And when I went through your material, I said to myself, this is a shift that some of the biggest companies, or there is a shift, let me change my words, there is a shift that some of the biggest companies in the world are implementing, and it is something that really is having to go mainstream. But first I want you to answer a question. Who came up with a Corporate Anthropology Advisor label?
So I coined the phrase corporate anthropology to describe the way I was approaching companies. I'm a PhD, I have a degree in psychology and education, I've been trained as a psychoanalyst, and what I found is when I went into companies, Margaret Mead went into the jungle and looked at cultures and how people behaved and physical spaces and the nature of communications. When I went into a company, it wasn't just as simple as seeing how they describe themselves, either in writing or in interview. It was really about creating the deep study of organizations through understanding their company cultures, their mores, their values, the diversity that they represented, both diversity of thought and diversity among the workforce. It was looking at their physical space. It was looking at the roles of individuals. It was looking at how they compensated people, how they organized to accomplish strategic initiatives. And so, you know, when you start to look at all of those variables, which is the way that I diagnosed and studied and impacted and defined how I could work with these companies to increase and enhance value, there was no overriding term. And what I found is my inspiration from anthropology, because when an anthropologist goes into the bush, whether they're studying Aborigine cultures in Australia or, cultures anywhere else in the world, they really look at those things, how humor is used, how people relate to each other, how they organize in terms of organizational design. And so I became a corporate anthropologist.
I find your approach is a very insightful approach. And in some ways, I could see where people would think it's sort of ridiculous. Why in the world would you take on this approach? But a business, in my view, whether you are a single person, but especially when you're developing a company, it is something that is a living entity. It is composed of people that are doing various levels of responsibility. And the truth is, there's no such thing as an insignificant position in a company. There just isn't. Whether it's the janitor or the CEO, every single position is important. And I really liked a lot of your approaches relative to developing communication with people. But for the sake of my audience, you start your book off with two cultures. You call it the alpha culture, and then the other one, the beta culture. Now, I know many of these different corporations are extremely complex. When you have thousands of people working for a corporation, it's much different than working with one that's one or two because of the time involvement and the detail that you have to work with. But for my audience, would you say, give a description, a brief description, of what you define as the alpha corporation and the beta corporation?
I will do. And the one thing I wanted to say is you're absolutely right. No matter what kind of company you have, it is people coming together with a common goal and purpose. In the alpha organization, it's much more traditional. It's much more centralized. It's much more hierarchical. There typically is a pyramid in how they organize with a single leader. It's based on the military model. So there'll be a senior leader in charge, and then under that senior leader, there'll be different functions that report in, and under those functions, there'll be several troops that reported to that person. What we find in how I describe the alpha culture, and it's worked for a very, very long time, it is less transparent, it's more secretive, information flows from the top, it's very command and control in its approach. In my book, and it's very traditional, and as I say, many corporations today, many great corporations today are organized that way, but things are changing, and we can talk about that. Mm-hmm. And I see the way things are changing is we're moving from the industrial age to what I call the connected economy. You know, we all are connected in so many different ways that not only technology, but the whole human rights movement has opened up consciousness and connected us in different ways. But certainly technology and the way we all chime in with each other and the way we're our collective wisdom comes together is one of the changes afoot. And so I call the new organization, the new way of organizing, the beta way, which is smaller, decentralized, more horizontal, more shared leadership, more collaborative teams, more equal distribution of rewards, more inclusive, where collective wisdom is mined, leadership is more authentic. Things flow top down, bottom up. I compare the alpha model to the military model where there's a general and lieutenants and sergeants, etc. And I compare the beta model to an orchestra where there's an orchestra leader. Leadership is still important, but where depending on the piece, depending on the challenge in business, different parts of the orchestra come into play. And you organize the strings, the woodwinds, et cetera, depending on the piece of music. The leader still leads, but they pick the best talents from the orchestra to play the piece in synchronicity. And that's how I see a beta culture.
I think this is illustrated very, very well, not in a corporate environment per se, but by the story of your grandmother, because you had a wonderful example given as how one person, your grandmother, affected the lives of more than 500 people. Tell the story about your grandmother, because that is a tremendous foundation of relevance to what you are expressing in this book.
Yes. One of the most important influences in my life was my grandmother, who came to this country when she was just approaching 16 years old, with her younger brother, who was about 5 years old at the time. They were being brought to America from Russia because the war was on, and they had lost, they were two of 13 children. And everyone else in the family, her parents and the rest of the children, had their demise in the war. And so a relative in America invited her over and took them in. So she came to America on a very long journey, holding her brother's hand, caring for him all the way, only to find that the relatives wanted to adopt the boy, and my grandmother was relegated to the basement to be more or less a domestic and help the family in all of their chores. My grandmother didn't speak any English, and it was a very difficult journey for her, and you could imagine how it was to live downstairs. It was sort of an upstairs-downstairs situation. She was so happy that her brother was living upstairs and in a fantastic manner and going to school, but of course she wasn't happy with her lot as being treated the way she was treated. So one day in doing her errands, she went to the local grocery store, and she had the wherewithal to say to the owner, "I'm a very good worker. I'm a very hard worker. Could you give me a job here?" And he was very taken by this woman and how she spoke up for herself and how she wanted to make advancement in her life. And so he hired her, and he gave her a place to sleep above the shop. Long story short, she ended up marrying the shopkeeper's son, who was my grandfather. And together, they took in her brother, who they raised to be a well-known doctor in New York. My grandmother, knowing that story of her story, wanted to influence the lives of other immigrants that came to America. And over the course of her life, whenever people came, and she developed a network of these people from all over the world, to America and landed in New York, she would feed them because they were in the food business. She had at this point helped my grandfather develop a very big enterprise, and she would then give them some money to start their careers and help them and counsel them as to how they could get ahead in America. And basically, my grandmother is the inspiration for the work I do. Not only do I counsel companies, but I counsel very senior, very high-potential talent about what are the best ways for them to exercise their leadership and how to make advancement in their careers.
This, I think, is significant because your grandmother was a woman that didn't just talk. She did. And she was very much aware of the human connection. And at that time in American history, a woman really didn't have very many choices. But she didn't discriminate whether it was male or female. She said if you wanted to do something, she would be supportive of you. And that's what she did. Now here we are in 2013. Your statistics are relating to 2012. More than 90%, I'm quoting directly from your book, more than 90% of nurses are female, while at the same time women make up only 11% of the engineers and roughly 86% of elementary school teachers and more than 60% of secondary school teachers are female, yet only 24% of full university professors and researchers are women. And these are areas of professionalism that just have been standard. My grandmother, who was born in 1900, she had two options, be a nurse, work with a bedpan, or, and at that time, that's what basically they did. Their education was very limited as nurses. That's not today's world. Today's world is much more sophisticated, but in the early, in 1900, teaching was basically one of the few options other than doing laundry. Today, because of education, women have a lot of options. Over 51% of entrepreneurs are women. they operate very differently in their own enterprises, it has been found, than men do. And it's not that what men do is bad, and it's not that what women do is absolutely perfect. It isn't. There is a harmony and a balance that needs to be developed and appreciated, and I think we're slowly but surely getting to that. And that's one point that you address in your book, The Fall of the Alphas, because it is utilizing the strengths of both genders. Give us the differences that you have noticed in your research in the companies that you go to, and how you feel that this can be adjusted and adapted.
So, Donna, things are changing, and things are changing for women, which is very exciting. You know, when I first came into the workforce, and I talk about this in The Fall of the Alphas, there was what I called the alpha female. And that was, in order to get ahead in business, you had to really enter, as somebody once said to me, you're entering a man's world. You know, and in fact, the first generation of working women, there were books called Games My Mother Never Taught Me, which is how to play in the corporate world. Mm-hmm. I tell a story about one of my first meetings in business where they asked who would take meeting notes, and I volunteered. And one of the guys said to me after the meeting, never do that. They'll see you as a secretary. And in fact, what I tell young women now is, you know, if you take the notes, if you are there to document the meeting, that's great power. You know, it's changed in our perspective. You're the keeper of information. You're the keeper of knowledge. That's great power. And so the first generation of women were trying to mirror men. They were tougher. In fact, there were lots and lots of musings during that time that women were tougher. They were tougher on other women, you know, because they were breaking through the glass ceiling, and they had to be tough, and they had to kind of play the man's game, so to speak, the alpha game. But what happened is, as more and more women came into the workforce, they brought with them their relational skills, their nurturing skills, their skills of connectivity. You know, even though they were still powerful in the way they did work, they were able to, you know, bring their emotional intelligence to the table. And what that did was really wonderful because, as you said, it brought balance to men. Men were able to talk about, you know, their relational skills. They were able to become leaders that understood collaboration. You know, the whole enterprise was able to recognize what at first was negatively called soft skills, which then became core to leadership. And it's been miraculous. We still need to do more work. You know, I think Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, which I admire, you know, has done a great job at empowering women, but more importantly, it's raised some of the issues that men need to be aware of in terms of how women in the workplace feel, and I think that's been a great contribution. And I think the move now, which is such a positive movement in our country, is to get women included on more corporate boards. You know, having just been a corporate board member myself, you know, it's just so nice to be at the table to really bring a skill set to bear and to represent a diversity.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, there we are.
I'm here to bring a diversity of thought to bear. And so, you know, again, things are changing for the positive.
All right. I noticed that my guest, Dana, her...
I'm here.
Okay. I hear the popping out, so I didn't know what was going on. Your signal is dropping.
I'm not sure what that is. Forgive me.
Yes. Oh, well, that's sometimes phone lines do wacky things. I want to make a comment about, actually, I want to share information out of your book regarding the fall of the alphas. There has been a lot of scientific research, and I find that this is so amazing. To me, it's even amazing that people are spending the time doing this, because I think if someone's a good leader, it doesn't make any difference what their gender is. If they're a leader, they're a good leader. They are that, period. But the research has been, can women be good leaders? It's as if this isn't something that's supposed to be. And that's the most ridiculous concept in my mind. And your book, you state, women can be just as effective as leaders and investors as men. And there was an Indian village where local laws mandated female leadership in at least one-third of the nation's village councils. Well, in Native American culture here in North America, that was standard. That was something that was absolutely mandatory. They had more of a matriarchal positioning. If the women said, you don't go to war, you didn't go to war. I don't care how hot-tempered the men might be, they didn't go to war. And in a number of other things. But it always was a cooperative level of understanding. They didn't demean the woman's role as it has evolved to this point in time, which I find very interesting with history. But they have found, and this is in many parts of the third world countries, that women are better at doing certain projects many times, maintaining whatever needs to be maintained, which in your book, it's wells that for water, and they didn't get involved with taking as many bribes. And there is this wonderful man, Grameen Bank, Muhammad Yunus, who has 97% of his microloans that he gives to women. He said the women use the money better than the men. And one of the reasons is that in that culture, the men actually, in many respects, have been dumbed down. When you make women subservient, you affect the males as well. And that's one of the points that I think your book brings out, is that it's so important for us to realize that it is talent, it is ability. How do we work together as a team? And that's your beta model. How do we collectively work in a harmony so that we're going to bring out the best, so that a company, an environment is going to really work together to be effective? And you list a number of businesses that do this very well. Facebook is one. Google is another. These things have been implemented. Are they perfect? No. But they have done a switch. It's just incredible. So we're going to take a break here. When we come back, we'll continue a conversation with Dana, the fall of the Alphas. We're going to take a short break so we can get her back.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Dana speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Dana Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Amino Muscle Snack Time, the chewable nutrition that feeds your muscles. Amino acids are the building blocks of protein. When you exercise, muscle tissue naturally breaks down. This low-cal, chewable snack helps to reverse that process and won't pack on the pounds. You can chew a few tasty vanilla tablets or any one of their other flavors before or after physical exercise, right before bedtime or first thing in the morning to jumpstart your metabolism into gear for the day. Convenient to carry in a purse, backpack, or briefcase, they are a tasty snack for the person on the go. Firm, fit muscles, trim, healthy body. Sound good to you? Check out Amino Muscle Snack Time Chewable Nutrition by going to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Tone up, trim up, and nourish your body to the fitness level you desire. Amino Muscle Snack Time Nutritional Tablets. Check out the information and order today. Go to Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Order now.
Hello, we have Dana back. Dana, I was asking the question before we had the challenge there. I was asking the question, what is most inspiring to you regarding those companies like Facebook, Google, Amazon, and some others? And you've listed a number of them in your book, The Fall of the Alphas. What has been the most inspiring aspect to you because of their attitudes of not making things gender-specific, of working with people as a team? What has inspired you the most?
What inspires me the most is just watching how particularly the millennials, that are used to growing up, staying connected. You know, they crowdsource whether they're going to the movies or how to help each other. They have social consciousness. And what's been inspiring in all those companies, and big and small, you know, how the next generation is coming into the workforce already with this mindset of collaboration, of how can we work together, both inside with our customers, how can we're moving from the place where hierarchies are being replaced by networks, and these networks are being founded, you know, within companies. People are sharing information, they're communicating with each other, they have a common purpose and a common good. It's not about silos, it's not about derailed egos on how I can get the promotion, how my team can advance at the fault of others. It's a movement that's happening all across the country, in big companies and small companies, and actually all across the world, because these enterprises are going global. And to watch people from different parts of the world, you know, communicating and working on, you know, documents together, and, you know, finding the best talent in the company to take on a project, that is what I'm talking about in beta cultures. And I see that percolating everywhere, and that warms my heart. I think that's the wave of the future.
There are two words that are starting to become a buzzword: social entrepreneurship. And I think that dovetails with exactly what you have just mentioned. And complementing your comment about the networking effect, over, 2 billion people have access to the web, and there's over 300 million websites. Now, those are numbers for the average person to wrap their mind around. It's just almost incomprehensible. I mean, that's a lot of connection. And there's the positive and the negative of that, but understanding that and working with that and realizing that we all are connected. I mean, there's just this phenomenal interconnection that really has always been there. I think the wise person has understood that, but it hasn't typically been taught in business school. It hasn't been something that individuals really wanted to enforce in the way of teaching and learning. There are people like Peter Drucker and some others that did it to a degree. But I look at this, and I want to ask you a question. When you are interacting with these companies, and you have people that have been trained in certain modalities of attitude, I think almost of the J.P. Morgan demeanor, when you find out about how it was the big guy or gal at the top, this is it. I've encountered some clients through the years that have worked with corporations that were headed by women, very much like you talked about. They were trying to be men. They mimicked the status quo. This is something that is sometimes very, very hard to change. We have many parts of the world in international business environments. They are sticking to this. There's not been enough time for the younger generation to know how to adapt, to shift, to be able to create the difference. And sometimes people are looked at being weak when they're of the beta mentality. How do you overcome that?
Betas are strong leaders. It's not an excuse for somebody being a coach and a mentor and a sponsor of good work. It's just you don't feel, as in the alpha model, that you're omnipotent as a leader, and your idea is the right idea, and your sensibility is the right sensibility. And people will, you know, if you look at the history of business, you know, we've gotten in trouble because, you know, you fire the CEO and you replace the CEO. And, you know, meanwhile, you have all these people in the company that are high contributors. that, you know, you kind of neuter, because they've been doing really good work. They've just been following a strategy and maybe haven't had the benefit of weighing in on what they see, and they haven't been consulted, and somebody's taken them down a path that maybe was myopic, and again, it was perhaps ego derailment of a strong alpha leader. The model that I'm proposing still has strong leadership, but the beta leader consults people in the company at all levels. You know, I'm always taken by this show called The Undercover Boss, where see somebody coming in, the CEO, and they go into the field, and they meet the people that actually are contributing to the success of the company. At the end of the hour, you know, they're left in tears saying, I just didn't know I had such good people working for me. I just didn't know what they were up against. And I say, fire that person. You know, if they didn't really understand what was happening and how it trickled down. I was with a CEO the other day who was talking about a sales call that he made and how he really created great insight into how things had changed from the days where he was a foot salesman, you know, selling a similar kind of product. And I wanted to hug him, you know. Because he got out of his ivory tower, he went out with his salespeople. He wanted to understand what they were up against. He wanted to understand how he could give them better tools and better materials and better sponsorship for them to do their job in a really good way. That's a beta leader. He's still a very strong presence in the company. He still is, you know, crafting a direction and communicating a strategy. But the way he gets there is by really using his team, consulting his team, communicating with his team on how to get the best result.
Dana, you have an excellent example in your book about hiring and how many times when a company is bought by another entity, everybody expects to lose their job. I know in media, having been involved in this industry for so many years, the common theme was by all of the employees, well, if we've been purchased, we're all going to be out of jobs, give it a month, and we're going to be gone. And typically that was it. And you tell a story in your book, and we won't have time to go in detail, but just to summarize it, you tell the story about there was somebody that was being considered for a position, and they had sort of this aggressiveness, and you advised them wisely. Get to know the people here. Don't hire, don't fire, don't do anything. Go in and really pay attention, just what you mentioned, to what's going on here. This is a good company. You have a chance for a very good positioning here. But understand the structure. Understand the network. Understand the people. And that is what I think is a theme that really needs to be pushed to the forefront. Before you dump people, find out what they do.
Exactly. And that's becoming part of the new beta way of thinking and articulating about the future of work. It used to be that big companies would buy, you know, smaller companies or merge with companies, and then they would say, our culture, very alpha, our culture is the prevailing culture, let's make them us. So here's our systems, here's our performance management system, here's how we organize, let's pick who's going to be integrated, who we have to let go, you know, and let's make them us, let's brand them as us. And, you know, what happened is if you look at the history of those kinds of acquisitions, many of them failed, or many of them, they bought companies, you know, for their intellectual clout and property and for their, you know, the way they approach the audience, and then they watered it down. And so the new way and the future of work is companies taking an interest, companies taking an economic interest, and then finding ways to get the best practices of the culture. That's what beta leaders do. What do they do that really can impact us? And then, in some instances, letting the companies run as divisions hands off, letting the leadership manage the way they manage, you know, bringing in new audiences, slowly evolving the integration. You know, it's sort of like marriages. You know, people come from two different cultures. You know, if they don't form a new culture of the young couple, you know, about the best practices and understanding from each family, you know, they're destined
to have a difficult time in their relationship. The same thing happens with companies, and we don't take the time, you know, or we haven't in the past taken the time, you know. Mm-hmm. And so there's a real respect. A recent example would be Yahoo's fantastic acquisition of Tumblr, which is a brilliant company, and really allowing that team to still continue with their excellent, excellent product and developing their marketplace and being glad that they have that window on the world, you know. And so, you know, they're to be applauded. And we're seeing much more of that. And it's happening in the tech and the biotech world. It's happening in lots of consumer products where they're buying brands and allowing the brands to flourish with their marketplaces. And that's creating what I say, the connection economy, is connecting things rather than, you know, taking over, rather than, you know, imposing an alpha culture on them.
I agree. And I think that this can be applicable, whether it's in education, whether even in politics, for heaven's sakes. I think that we need to understand that it makes a difference how we think, how we communicate, and not only that, but the actions that follow. And there are many different components you bring out. You bring out the stories about different companies in your book, The Fall of the Alphas. Dana Arty, what is the website people can go to find out more about your very interesting book?
Oh, thank you so much. My website is www.corporateanthropologyadvisors.com, or you know, they can Google Dr. Dana Arty and they'll get there that way. But, you know, I'd love to have people who find The Fall of the Alphas interesting to start a dialogue and let me know what they're thinking, how their companies are organized. And, you know, the mission here is to create a world where we all feel that we're, as you said before, making contribution at work, that we all work in places where we feel valued and where companies flourish because people are excited and come to the table to collaborate with other people and be effective and bring value and create enterprise that wins.
Absolutely, because that, when you work together as a team, the aspect everybody wins really applies. And it's a very, very good attitude to have. This is Donna Sebo. My guest has been Dana Arty, The Fall of the Alphas. It is a really good read, very good thinking, and some fabulous stories about people that have implemented this very kind of system in their own industry area and how successful it has been. Donna Sebo here. Dana Arty, thank you so much for being my guest. This is Donna Sebo. We're coming back in just a moment. Don't go away.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Good health is something all of us want to have. Being aware of what we eat, its nutritional value, and how to balance our physical needs with our busy schedules is always a challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time goes a long way towards helping us meet this challenge. Amino Muscle Snack Time is a nutritional food product that is portable, tasty, and in chewable tablet form, vanilla and honey flavors, a bonus for maintaining a healthy amino acid balance for healthy muscles. Amino Muscle Snack Time can be used anytime, anywhere, first thing in the morning to kickstart your metabolism. Take 20 minutes before or after a workout to help recover and build muscle. Take mid-morning or mid-afternoon to help curb cravings for unhealthy snacks. Weight loss, appetite control. Only top-of-the-line and no genetically modified ingredients are used, no caffeine added. These chewable tablets can be ordered through Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com. Take charge and jumpstart your food program by adding Amino Muscle Snack Time by visiting Amazon.com or SquatSponge.com for more information. Order now.
Hello, this is Donna. Welcome back. I'm so delighted that you have been able to join me at this broadcasting table. By golly, we're going to be talking tomorrow with Margaret Johnston. This is a woman who's done research about various belief systems around the world and how it's changed, and especially related to spirituality. And her book is titled Faith Beyond Belief. Margaret Johnston is going to be my guest tomorrow. Fascinating details and information that she's come up with. And then the On Message with Zach Friend. Yes, we're going to be talking about a subject matter that makes you aware that who you are does make a difference. And I believe that very strongly. And then The Sacred Journey of the Heart by Rana Prince. Wonderful people, wonderful ideas. And you can always check on our site here for show information. And there's a brief write-up and usually some bio information about the person that is going to be coming on the air with me. We just have so many talented people on this planet. And I think that's one of the joys of doing this show. And it has expanded my world in just a phenomenal way. And, of course, my library is just immense. When you interview over 3,000 people, you can't claim not to know or have an awareness of the diversity in life, which I enjoy. I really, really do. I think it's marvelous to see the various concepts and ideas and enthusiasm that people have for various areas of interest. And we all benefit in our own ways. I can recall when I was in the former Soviet Union in 1992, and it really brought home to me the reality of the American essence of let's see what we can do. If there's a challenge, something's not working, let's make it happen. This is something that is representative of the American spirit. And America is not a piece of property. It is more than that. It is an essence of a belief that, number one, we have the right to be free. And number two, that freedom gives us the right to create, to adapt, to expand. Good, bad, or indifferent, this has been one of the greatest aspects of the American spirit. The two words, you can, make a difference. In a lot of parts of the world, you cannot. I was watching a video on a village in an area of India, and it's about the water women. These women were absolutely, totally confined because all kinds of belief systems that have been in place for thousands of years. They were confined to just being committed to carrying water. Sometimes they'd have to walk 8 miles. To watch this story, to see the interviews of these women, and how one woman came into their environment, started holding a meeting once a month, gently educating the women that they could make income for their families. Now, these women, if they brought this up to their husbands, they would be beaten. The men were supposed to be the ones to make the income. Women, you have the babies, you walk and you get the water, and you take care of the family. The woman's day began early in the morning. May still be going on today the same way, but changes came in. Changes came in, slowly but surely. One educated woman started having this monthly meeting with the other women in the village saying, you can learn how to make money. You can improve your family situation. It was heartbreaking to watch an interview with one woman who just, she said her husband beat her whenever she brought up new ideas. And she was afraid because of if she went to this meeting, if her husband found out about it, she would be beaten. She would be punished. Eventually, because things got so desperate, she started going to the meetings and the other women supported her. They were very gentle with her, because they had all gone through something similar themselves. Eventually, she was able to see how she could start generating money, how she could start generating income. a microloan. Yes, a microloan was given to her. The other women had to improve it. The Council of Women had to approve this woman's desire to benefit her family. They counseled her. They worked with her. It took her a long time to gain the courage to become a part of this. But when things got really, really bad, her husband was a shoemaker. He couldn't make a good living. And she said, enough is enough. So she started doing things, and eventually, the little bit of money that she made was making a difference as to whether her family could eat or not. Sometimes we have to begin with tiny steps. This woman's life is encased in fear. Neither she nor her husband are literate. She was open to becoming literate. She was open to saying, finally, after getting past some fears, she still goes and collects the water every day. That hasn't changed. The men won't do it. But what they showed towards the end of the documentary is that slowly but surely, there is a shift in the thinking among the water women of this particular area of India and even of the men. The men, little by little, are beginning, many times because of the fact that maybe their wives die while they're in childbirth or things of this nature. You see, it's not a male or female issue. It should never be that. It's who can do what best? What is it? How can we work together to collectively to be able to make things happen? This is, again, what America represents. In Russia, former Soviet Union, I saw firsthand what oppression does to creativity. I saw firsthand the failure of an economic structure. I saw in the former Soviet Union in 1992 people that could not even get butter because there was not but one refrigerator truck we ever saw, and it wasn't in the Moscow area. There were others. It was amazing what I was able to see. We take so much for granted, but we need to understand it is an infrastructure of support on so many levels that has made the American way of life possible. When you take that away, when you break it down, when you don't respect it, when you're not willing to build, maintain, and expand and operate more efficiently and better, you're going to collapse. That's what happens. Out of that collapse, though, many times, you can rise like a phoenix and make the world a much better place. We are in the throes at this time of a collapsing of antiquated systems. There is an implosion that is going on. I can't say that it's all bad, but it is necessary. Most of us, if we're cozy and comfortable, we're not going to step out of our paradigms, are we? No, it feels good. Why are we going to do that? So usually it's when we have a shakeup. We have to understand that we're either going to move and do what's necessary to make the shift. Otherwise, we are going to be subject to somebody else's whims. We don't need to do that. And again, that is what I think makes the American spirit great. Because it's not black, white, yellow, green, alien from outer space. It's not that at all. It's not male. It's not female. It is a belief that we can fix, we can correct, we can make better what needs to be made better. Doesn't mean it's not going to have its pain and suffering at times. I guarantee you, growth is not something that we usually get real excited about. Think of when you were a teenager. Did you want to grow up? When you were a teenager, you had your family. If you were fortunate, you had a family that was there. You weren't held responsible for too many things. When you're an adult, the magic time, 18, all of a sudden, hey, you're an adult. Forget it. You have to stand on your own 2 feet. This is something that a lot of people don't want to do. They dig in their heels, say, I don't want to grow up. and many of them don't. And many of them have a lot of challenges and problems. But you have to grow up at some point. And that is what I think as a nation, as a people, we are beginning to understand. It's time to grow up and to have a mature attitude about what needs to be done. No banging of cymbals, no screaming, no ranting, no raving. Let's just deal with the facts. And when we can do that in our everyday life, then we're contributing to the betterment of everything around us. So you don't have to be a CEO of a company. You can be a mom that has kids to take care of, works at a job. You can be a dad. You can be someone that's running a small business. No matter who you are, you're significant. And that is very, very important for you to remember. You make a difference. And you may not be written up in a major publication somewhere, and there may not be trumpets blowing. When you share your wisdom, your understanding, and your willingness to learn with others. But who cares? Know that you make a difference because of your willingness to grow as a person, willingness to hold true to your own integrity, a willingness to be true to yourself above all things. That is what makes a ripple effect that goes on and on and on. You are significant. And I want you to know that because it makes such a big difference in this world. And I wanted to, well, there's a number of things that I was going to share with you today. We're going to be out of time within just a moment here. But I want to leave you with a thought, not just of the fact that you're the master of your own, you know, your own fate, your own destiny to a great degree, but I want you to remember your mind, your feelings, your emotions, who you are is you. But you can shift and change into something that is bigger within yourself that needs to come out. Whether it is creativity, whether it is leadership skills, whether it is just being wide-eyed about this magnificent thing we call life. You are important. You're needed. Be true to yourself. And as I always say at the end of every show, remember always you're the master of your fate. You're the captain of your soul. That's your property. Nobody owns it. Don't ever forget that. Because that is the spirit of the real you that is meant to shine with all of its brightness to its greatest capacities. This is Donna Siebel. Join me tomorrow. We are going to be talking about faith beyond belief. Interesting perspective from a woman that has done a lot of research through a lot of history. We'll be talking with you tomorrow, same time, same place. God bless. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.